listening to violinist and 2023 NEA Jazz Master Regina Carter. And this is Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. This is the second of a two-part podcast with jazz artist Regina Carter. Last time we traced Regina's musical evolution, her upbringing in Detroit and the influence of that city on her musical development. We learned about her training in classical music and her transition to jazz, her early experiences playing jazz in Detroit, and her move to New York City, where she performed with a variety of artists, from Dolly Parton to Max Roach. We pick up today's podcast where we left off. Regina had just released her first two solo albums when she received a pivotal call from Wynton Marsalis to tour with his Pulitzer Prize-winning oratorio, Blood on the Fields.
My first two records were categorized as smooth jazz. And I had that market that I was working in. But when I received a call from Wynton to tour with Blood on the Fields, touring with that group put me on the map, put me on the jazz map. Having that type of exposure, you can't buy that. And it was such an incredible time, just the piece, what it was about, what everyone had to learn and feel and go through. And basically, my piece came at the very end. And it was maybe about 3 minutes, 4 minutes worth of music. And I just started to myself, if this is the only time I get to play during these 2 hours, I'm going to milk this. Just started playing a little bit longer each night. But it was an incredible time for me. And, you know, I thank Wynton for calling me for that.
As you moved further in your career, many of your albums began to center around a theme. I think your first themed record might have been Motor City Moments, your love song to Detroit. How did this celebration of Detroit come together?
I have so many wonderful memories from growing up in Detroit, and I wanted to make a record celebrating some of the folks, some of the musicians and people and some of the experiences I had. So I thought about some of the musicians I wanted to honor, so to speak, and some of the tunes I chose aren't by Detroit composers, like Chattanooga Choo Choo. That was the first tune, the first dance, tap dance piece that I tapped to. I learned a routine on that in dance school. So that represented my life growing up taking tap and ballet in Detroit. Love Thing from Spartacus, I heard Yusef, the great Yusef Lateef, recorded that, and I fell in love with it and wanted to record that. Then, of course, I had Marcus Belgrave on a couple of tracks. I had to have him. I was so thrilled that he recorded with me. Also, Barry Harris, the great pianist Barry Harris. And it was so wonderful having Barry in the studio and with Marcus, and they told these amazing stories. I wish that we had had a video camera rolling because there was so much history. And I remember talking to Barry on the phone, and he says, well, what do you want to record? And I said, well, I want to do Fuku Aijo. And he said, well, how does that go? And I laughed because it's one of his tunes. And in my mind, what? But you think about it, he's written thousands of tunes. He's not going to remember every tune. It was such a beautiful moment for me.
You also recorded one of your tunes, Up South, this great bluesy duet with guitarist Russell Malone. That leads me to ask you about your own compositions and how you approach composing and what inspires you and what's your process for actually doing that.
My process, fire under the butt, is usually what works. With Up South on that record, Motor City Moments, I wanted to also recognize the migration, the great migration of people coming up from the South. And my dad's family, there were 14 kids and 13 siblings. And so they all came up one at a time and would get a job and then bring the next sibling up and get them situated. And my dad was from Alabama. He was from a coal mining town that doesn't exist anymore, Bradford, Alabama. And my grandfather, who I'd never met, was a coal miner. But I wanted to honor my father, and so I wanted to do Up South, but I didn't want it to be your 12-bar blues. I wanted it to be like the original blues, where there was no form to it. It was really about a feeling. And so Russell Malone was the perfect person to have for that, great guitarist, and he's from the South as well. So it was just a lot of fun. We just kind of went in. I told him my idea, and we laid down two takes, and that was it.
Throughout your career, you continue this exploration of family history through your music, particularly the albums Reverse Thread and then Southern Comfort. These are real histories in music.
You know, early on, dealing with record companies, the A&R people would always say, well, we need a story. What's your story? And my very first record on Verve was entitled Rhythms of the Heart, which doesn't really say anything. You have to make a story out of that. And it was all music and all styles that I enjoyed playing. I didn't want that record on Verve to put me in a box. So musically, so I was kind of all over the map, as people would say. So it's different types of tunes. And sometimes I'm like a kid in the candy store when I'm thinking about a project. I chase the shiny things. You know, 2 seconds I'm here, and, oh, I'm going to do this. And then another second I'm over here. So I have to really make myself focus. And I remember I decided I wanted to do a record and trace my family history. I'd done an ancestry test and ancestry.com. And I knew about my mother's side of the family, pretty much. I knew my aunts and uncles on my father's side, and I knew my grandmother, but I didn't know anything about my father's father, except he was a coal miner. I didn't really know anything about him, so I said, I'm going to do research to see where did he live, what years did he grow up, what was the music that was happening. And he came up in the Appalachian region, so there was music from Africans, the Native Americans, Scots, Irish, all of this mixed in together to create this beautiful Americana sound, if you will. I think I spent probably 2 years researching and working on this record and coming up with repertoire. And then I would play live somewhere and say, okay, no, I need to change this instrument or I want this. And after I recorded that record, when it was being mastered, when my mom passed in 2005, I'd moved all her stuff to Jersey, and I had a couple of boxes in our house. And I finally said, okay, these boxes have got to go. And I opened up the one box, and there was a sheet she had put together with all of the siblings and my grandparents' pictures on it. So this is my first time seeing my grandfather. Like, I don't believe in coincidence, you know. I felt that that was perfect timing for Southern Comfort.
And that, with Southern Comfort, Americana, jazz, traditional music, and more, just merged together so beautifully with Appalachian and Cajun fiddle tunes. I mean, folk songs. It was, what an album that was. And Cornbread Crumbled and Gravy, that just stays with me. Tell me why you chose to put that on, and thank you for doing that. I love that song.
A lot of the tunes that I recorded on Southern Comfort were from field recordings that I had heard. And Cornbread Crumbled and Gravy, just the voice, it was just a recording of a woman singing. And it was just something that touched me so deep inside with that song. I felt like I have to do this song. It was so interesting because one night we were playing in a club playing music from the CD, and there was a busload of tourists that came in. One woman came up to me and she said, I know that melody. My mom used to sing it to me when I was little, but the words are different. And so it's just one of those things how you can see how music and art travels and how connected we are. And going back to Reverse Thread, sometimes I listen to music from different parts of the continent of Africa, and I say, oh, that sounds like this music here. We're all connected. So I just said, we're all a piece of one fabric. And if you start to pull that string and unravel us, that's humanity. That's who we are.
The violin itself, I think, can often be such a misunderstood instrument. It's revered. You've said people regard it as precious. And yet it is an instrument that is played through so many cultures around the world. This most revered of classical instruments is a world instrument.
Right. The violin, if you look at every culture of music across the globe, almost every culture has an instrument that's either a violin, fiddle, or something from which the violin came out of, whether it's an Ndingi Day, which is the violins used in Uganda, or the Ganji fiddles, one string with the bow. In every culture, there's Indian classical music or their folk music. There's, yeah, like I said, every culture has a music that violin or something similar to violin is used in. And so it's funny when I'm doing workshops sometimes with children and their parents will say, don't you think it's important that, you know, students start off playing classical music? And I said, who's classical music? Because every culture has its own classical music. As long as you learn how to play the instrument, you learn the technique of it, you can learn that playing anything. I see a lot of my students and friends that play Irish fiddle music or American fiddle. I feel like they have a much better bow arm than a lot of European classical players, at least a lot better than mine. I feel like they're very fluid with their bow arms. I tell people it's a piece of wood with strings on it. And so I try to approach the violin with that in mind of don't be stuck in the limitations of what someone said this instrument is supposed to be able to do.
Well, speaking of violin and the mythic violin, you actually had the experience of playing Paganini's violin called the Canon in 2001, and you were the first jazz artist to play it. How did that happen?
Many years ago, actually right before 9/11, a good friend of ours was visiting from Genoa, and Andrea Liberovici, and you know, he was listening to a recording of a rehearsal I'd done. The great bassist and composer John Clayton had written some beautiful orchestra charts for me. And Andrea said, oh, this would be great for you to do a concert in Genoa and using Paganini's violin, which I thought, well, this will never happen. But he was excited about it. I didn't even give it a second thought. And in fact, when he went to the mayor of Genoa, who was a jazz fan, the mayor immediately said yes. But the violin, Paganini's violin, the Guarneri del Gesù, it belongs to the community in Genoa. So you have to have several people that say yes. And there was this long interview process. Some folks thought it was a great idea. Some people were totally against it, saying playing jazz on this instrument, well, devalue it and blah, 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 blah. So finally we got the okay. And I went over to Genoa and the promoter, the night before, a bunch of us had gone out to dinner, and he's telling us only a few tickets have sold. You know, if we don't sell more tickets, we have to pay for the hall. So they scheduled, my friend scheduled a press conference the next day, and I held the press conference, and they said, well, play something. So the first thing that came to my mind was Amazing Grace, which was one of my mother's favorite tunes. I thought, I'm going to play this to soothe all that's going on inside of me. They sold out all the tickets. The hall was packed. And it was just an amazing concert. People came and they loved the concert.
What about playing on the actual violin itself? What was that like? Did you have to adjust to it?
This violin is priceless. I had to go to a specific place to practice on the violin. And every violin is very different. The size, the strings, the shifting. And I tell people it's like knowing how to get around your bedroom in the dark and then someone going in and changing all the furniture around and didn't tell you. So you have to learn. And that's 2 days is not a lot of time to learn. But I knew what I could and couldn't do on that instrument, and it was much bigger than mine. When the violin came, it came with a whole line of police escorts. I thought, oh, wow, the Pope's in town. You know, it just, they were bringing the violin. The room I was in had these red velvet curtains, which they snatched closed. And I just remember being petrified playing this instrument and trying to figure out tunes to play using the instrument. John Clayton, again, said, try music from the French Impressionist period, because a lot of times the chords are more modern and easier to improvise over.
You also actually made a CD with that violin. called Paganini After a Dream. It's a beautiful CD, and I'd love you to talk about what it was like actually producing that CD.
The community of Genoa gave me permission to record an album. It was funny. My friend Andrea said, you might as well record a record. And I said, I think you're pushing it now. You know, they said yes once, leave it alone. But they said yes again. I picked some of the same tunes that we played on the concert there. But again, a lot of the French Impressionist tunes by them, Debussy, Fauré, Ravel, trying to pick tunes that were easy enough for me to navigate on that violin.
Given a MacArthur Award, the so-called Genius Award, in 2006, and that had to have been a red letter day for you.
Yeah, after I got married in 2004, and 6 months later, my mom was gone. Yeah, she made her transition, 6 months after we got married, and I spent her last couple of months with her in the hospital. I just stayed there with her. And it was a life-changing experience for several reasons, just watching that process. And then I played music sometimes, just sometimes when she couldn't communicate, I put music on and I could see how her vital signs would change. One, and I know, take that off and put something else on. While she was still here, I was supposed to play a big festival in another country. And I kept asking her doctor, is she going to be here when I get back? And he'd always say, I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know. And so I think 3 days before I was supposed to leave, the doctor said, she won't be here when you get back. And I knew then I'm not going. And so we called my agent and manager, and they called the festival. And the festival producer said, you're full of blank, and we're going to sue your blank. And they did. And the thing is that the contract was not written properly. They had left the incorporated off of my business name. And so if you leave LLC or incorporated off, they can sue you personally. So I thought now they can come after my stuff and my husband's because I just got married. So I was freaking out, and they were trying to deal. And I said, can I bury my mother and have like just a minute before we start dealing with this? And I remember calling all kinds of attorneys, and attorneys in that country wouldn't touch it. And finally, I found someone that helped me, and we settled. And I was so bitter after that. I was bitter. I just thought, how could someone in the music business be that cold and callous? And I didn't want to play anymore. And it was because of John Clayton said, if you don't play anymore, you've let them win. So I'm going through this whole thing, grieving my mother, having to go back to Detroit. I was holding on to her house just because I needed time. And the lawsuit was settled. And 2 days later, I got the call from the MacArthur Foundation. And if they had called me before, these people would have gotten that money. It had just consumed my life. I felt like that was my mother. That was my green light. And the sun came out. And it completely changed my life. It would have completely changed my life regardless. But because of all I had just gone through for an entire year, it was the sun I needed.
I mean, obviously, there's a great financial benefit that comes with that. And I wonder what that gave you the room to do other than take a breath, which clearly you needed to do.
Yeah, the gift from the MacArthur. I needed to take a break and breathe. I needed to have time to really grieve. And I needed to figure out what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go out on tour anymore. I just needed time to find myself, find my footing. And I thought I wanted to go to school to become a music therapist. And I talked to several music therapists, and one said, before you jump in, take an intro to music therapy course first. So I interviewed at several schools, and Western University in Kalamazoo, Michigan, they didn't have an online course. they set one up specifically for me. So it wasn't online. It was long distance learning. They would give me my assignments. I'd load them up. And then a couple of times a year, I'd have to fly to Michigan and spend time there, either being tested or following different music therapists around. And one of the therapists I followed worked in hospice. And I thought it was just such a beautiful gift, not only giving to the people that are making their transition, but what you get from the person that's making that transition. And I knew then that's what I wanted to do. So I became a hospice volunteer. I trained and I had a couple of patients. I saw them in their homes for a couple of years until they all passed away. And then I didn't do that anymore because I was traveling so much and it wasn't fair, I felt, to leave and be gone for 3-4 weeks and not be able to see my patients. Although no matter where I was, I called them when I was on the road and just talked to them and told them what was going on. And I think in the West, we don't really deal with death, that we don't talk about it. We don't want to, it's very uncomfortable, where other cultures celebrate it. It's a part of living. And so after many years, I decided I wanted to train and become an end-of-life doula. But I jumped way ahead. So with the Mega Earth there, I went to school and became a hospice volunteer and just took some time and then decided on the next record, which was Reverse Thread. And I shopped the label because I owned it. I wasn't with a label and I shopped it. And I told my manager at the time, I said, whoever takes this record, they have to take it as is, no changes. And it's funny how things work. Chuck Mitchell was at Verve. He was the reason, one of the main reasons I was signed to Verve, and he was leaving. He said, make sure she stays and take good care of her. And I always wanted to work with him. And so many, many years later, I shopped it to a label where he was, and he took it just as it was. And he said, listen, I'm not a musician, but here's a suggestion. You think about it, it's your record. His suggestion made total sense. So I used the money to start investing in myself and in my records so that I could own the masters. And that's something I learned from folks like Dee Dee Bridgewater and Abby Lincoln, is own your masters.
When you cut your record, and then when you go out and tour, are you opening up those records as you're performing them live? I'm just curious about the relationship between the live performance of the record in front of an audience and what happens in a studio.
When recording records in a studio, it can be a little intense. Yeah, and you don't want songs to be too long. You know, you're thinking about radio play. Can it be played on radio? How long is the tune? Different things you have to think about. And so when I'm playing live, those tunes definitely open up. People can take longer solos. Someone, they'll do something different that sparks something else that becomes this exciting, so it changes over time. And maybe a year or two later, if I have a sub in the band and I'm sending them the music and I look at the charts, I'm like, this is what we recorded, but we don't even do this anymore. So it could be difficult, but that's the beauty of playing live and the energy that you get back from an audience when you're playing. I feel like audiences are a part of what we do. We're not playing at them. They're actually involved. We need that energy.
Well, that leads me back to your work with hospice and playing for the people who were making that transition and the healing power of music that you alluded to. I would like to have you speak more to that, but also wonder if you feel that same kind of, I don't know, healing power or spirit when you're performing, not in a hospice situation, but live in front of an audience.
When I'm performing live, it's an amazing feeling, and especially when the group can lock in as one and you go into this other space. I don't even know. It's like we can communicate without words. And as I've gotten older, I think I play more with intention. What is it that I'm trying to say or get across? It's not just playing notes to get people to react, but playing something to hopefully get someone to feel something. I want to feel. I want the band to feel. I want them to feel. And I think working as a hospice volunteer helps me to get in touch with that. And so I try to be centered and say, what is it that I'm trying to say? I'm not trying to necessarily wow you. I'm trying to convey an emotion. I can't control how people accept, but I'm giving a gift. And I don't feel like it's mine. I feel like that God is working through me, or my higher power that if I can get out of the way and let that come through, that's the real gift.
I cannot not talk about you and Kenny Barron and your album, Free Fall. That was back 2001, I think. That was like a conversation between two brilliant instrumentalists. And I would just love a little background on that.
I met Kenny Barron, 2010 NEA Jazz Master and pianist. I met him years ago. I was playing with a group at the Telluride Jazz Festival. And he was listening to the group that I was with. And he and Marlena Shaw came up to the stage and introduced themselves. And Kenny said, I want to play with you one day. And before I could even catch myself, I said, yeah, right. And so we always laughed. And I just thought, oh, he's just being polite, you know. And many, many years later, we talked about it. And I played some gigs with him, not just duo, but sometimes with his group. And it just seemed like we had a connection, just a very natural musical connection. And so when we finally were able to, our schedules matched up and we were able to record this record, we just got together once and we both brought a list of tunes that we liked. We went through and we just kind of played through them quickly and say, oh, that works, this works, this works. And we spent 2 days in the studio just going through that list, playing them, so we could make a decision after that. Just an incredible time in the studio. I was so comfortable. Kenny Barron is just like, he's like a lake, just such a calm and wonderful human being. And I've learned so much. I consider him a mentor. I watched him and learned so much, not only from his playing, but just how he reacts or doesn't react in certain situations, which is a huge lesson.
Ella Fitzgerald is an important musical influence on you. What about Ella inspires you?
When I was a child growing up in Detroit, I remember there were some albums in one of the closets, and one was a record by Ella. I had no idea who she was, but I would just put these albums on. Ella took me to another place, a very calm place. It was like when a mother sings to her child, and I just loved hearing her voice. Of course, when I was introduced to jazz and started getting into the music and learning about all these people, it seemed like on several records, I would always choose an Ella tune to record. And so it was time for me to record a record. And I was like, ugh, I don't know what I want to do. And I was talking to Carla Cook. And she says, well, you love Ella. Why don't you do a tribute record to her? And I was like, that's a perfect idea. And not realizing that it was her 100th birthday that was coming up. And I knew that so many vocalists would probably be doing tribute records to Ella, but here I am. I'm not a vocalist, I'm a violinist. So because I knew so many people would do tribute records, I wanted to choose tunes that weren't as popular. You know, back in the day, you get an album, you had side A, and you flip it over and you had side B. And so I called it a B-side record. Tunes like Crying in the Chapel, Judy, which I could not find a recording of Ella singing that. But Judy, which the story, that's how she won the Night at the Apollo, and that put her on the map.
I'm so glad you mentioned Judy, because your violin in that, it's uncanny how much it sounds like a voice. Mentioned teaching, and we haven't talked about your teaching because your commitment to teaching is deep and it's broad. Why is this such an important part of your life?
When I was a child, my mom was a kindergarten teacher, and sometimes I would go to school with her instead of my own school, and I would help out or I'd watch her And as most children, I would imitate her at home. I'd set up my room like a classroom. But I swore, though, I would never teach. I don't know. I think seeing my mom come home after teaching and she'd come in the house and it drained you. Teaching, if you're a good teacher, it's a lot of energy. It just seemed like she was so tired. I just thought, I'm never doing that. But lo and behold, you know, I think the tradition that I got from Marcus Belgrave and so many other musicians in Detroit, it's just naturally in me to pass along the knowledge. And I actually enjoy it when I start working with students. I get really excited, especially if they want to learn. And I think it's important to pass on the tradition, not only of jazz, but just another, having another perspective about music, why you're playing music. And I always try to educate them a little bit about the business of music, because that's the one thing that I don't know any university or college that offers a business course for musicians, and that should be mandatory.
I know we're running out of time, but your latest project is so intriguing to me, Gone in a Phrase of Air.
That is a continuation of another piece I wrote some years back about Black Bottom, where my mother grew up in Detroit. And areas like Black Bottom and Paradise Valley were areas where Blacks and immigrants were forced to live. Some of the homes were funky and old. Some were really beautiful. And, you know, most people own their own businesses, really tight-knit communities. And Robert Moses said, if you want to get rid of these funky neighborhoods, just run a highway through these and then you can destroy these neighborhoods, which is what happened. The 1956 Highway Act was signed. And I-75 in Detroit was put through my mother's community where she grew up. And most of those people were not compensated for their homes and businesses and they were moved into projects or other places. I thought, this would be a great project. And so a dear friend of mine, poet Leslie Reese, her grandmother grew up in Black Bottom. And so Leslie interviewed all these people that had grown up in Black Bottom. And she turned some of their stories into like a tapestry. And I composed music to that. During that research, I found that it didn't just happen in Detroit, but it happened in almost every urban city across the United States. So I was inspired to keep researching that and writing music and adding photographs, showing some of these neighborhoods. And it's still happening. Redlining. So many people don't know about this, even adults, and they don't know that it's still going on. And so I continued this project. And Gone in a Phrase of Air is a title from Leslie Reese. She put it in one of the pieces for Black Bottom. And she said, I know some of these neighborhoods were old and funky, but they just tore them down. Gone in a Phrase of Air, just like they were never even there.
It's such a resonant title and such an important project. Thank you for doing that. You have been awarded through your career the trifecta, as we say, the MacArthur, the Doris Duke Award. Now you're named an NEA Jazz Master, and I do wonder what being named a Jazz Master means for you.
Being named a Jazz Master by the National Endowment for the Arts is still mind-blowing. In my mind, it's for someone that's lived a lot longer and had more experience. But I think in my head, I'm still a kid. And then my body says, no, you're not. But it's such a huge honor. You know, sometimes when you're working, you're doing what you do, you get so caught up in the everyday of this, this, and this. And when you're recognized by something this prestigious, this, it's like someone saying, you're doing okay. You're doing what you're supposed to do. Keep going. Keep going. My music, obviously, is touching some people. And that's what I want. And it just encourages me to keep creating.
Well, thank you. Thank you for giving me your time. Congratulations on this award. It is so well deserved. I couldn't be happier.
I appreciate that, really. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. That was violinist and 2023 NEA Jazz Master, Regina Carter. Regina Carter and the other 2023 Jazz Masters were celebrated at a fabulous tribute concert on April 1st at the Kennedy Center. If you didn't make it, or if you were there and want to experience it again, we have it at arts.gov. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. We would love to know your thoughts about the podcast. Email us at artworkspod@arts.gov. And follow us wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple. It helps other people who love the arts to find us. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.